Welcome to Foxcast number 6. I'm Sonny Fox, and this week, a self-deprecating, self-loathing, paranoid, schizophrenic, very funny man, the one and only Richard Lewis. When we sat down behind the microphones, the first question I asked Richard was, what one word describes you?
I would say prolifically self-loathing.
That's more than one word.
Well, fuck you. What is this, English class?
That's two words.
I can't describe myself. Yeah, you know, really, I don't know. I'm just, I'm prolific. People see, what they see is what they get. I never said one word except ouch when I came out of the womb and then oh no when I heard them. And I went back in. I actually hid in the womb.
For how long?
Well, my mother kept me in almost 12 months. I came out 33. She was pregnant with me 33 months because she had a mahjong tournament at Catskills. Hey, kept pushing me out.
As long as you're talking about when you were a kid, actually, an embryo.
Oh, God. What about it?
All I ever hear is, he's from New Jersey. I don't hear nothing about, like, where you
were. Brooklyn.
Oh.
I was born in Brooklyn, but I was the baby in the family. And then there was a gang war in my crib, and I literally, and I said, we got to get to Jersey. I'm too fragile for Brooklyn. That was just sort of West Side. That's back in the nice days when it was just like, you know, fist fights and an occasional penknife now, you know, third grade, you know.
Anyway, but after you were a kid, I mean, yeah. I know nothing about your...
I'm still a kid, Sonny.
Wow, that's true. But
Don't make me grow up in front of your audience.
What happened to you in, like, grade school?
What happened? What happened to me? First of all, my family was clueless about raising me.
Really?
I was the youngest. My sister had already... I ran off and had four children before I was like about 14. My older brother was like, you know, Beaver, and he was like Wally. He had, you know, Vaseline in his hair and torturing me, basically.
I was going to say, how much older was he than you?
6 years older, and, he gave me Catcher in the Rye and a book on the vagina, and then he left.
Well, most older brothers torture the shit out of their younger
No, but, brothers. You know, yeah, sibling crap, you know, yeah. But, you know, he's cool. But, I mean, they're all cool, but my parents were old when I was born. I know I was an accident. There is no doubt in my mind that I shouldn't be talking to you, Sonny.
Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, they hardly talk to me. Number two, my brother and sister were much older than me. By the time I was like two, everybody was like in their 50s and 60s. It was a joke. I ran the whole house when I was three.
They all had plans, right?
They had plans. I don't even know. I mean, the fact that they even had intercourse is a shocker, but most people think about that with their parents. But this had to be a mob thing. You know, you're going to have a child you don't want, you know, have intercourse or, you know, we'll blow your head off. And that's why I'm talking to you. So thank God that they forced my parents to screw, because otherwise, you know, I never would have been able to have been a comedian for 35 years, which is a lifelong dream, and I'm still doing it.
But you love your brother, right?
I love all of them, you know, and, you know, I unfortunately wear disguises when I'm around them so they can't recognize me. No, I'm just saying, look, at my age, in my middle to late 50s, I decided, first of all, I got married for the first time. I was dating a great woman. I said, you know what, I'm going to commit to something other than to strangers in an audience that I can't see because the light's so bright on me, which I insist on. I don't like to see people who might be dragged there by someone, you know, who might be, you know, a neo-Nazi and doesn't want to be there. They just want to get laid, and they become with this beautiful Jewish social worker. So what did you ask me? Oh, my family. They didn't have a clue. They didn't have a clue how to, and that's because their parents were clueless. They were from Poland and Romania and Russia. They didn't speak any English. My grandmother's driver's license was like 100 feet long, with her parallel parking being raped by a guy from Russia, one of these guys with a Siberian hat. The whole thing sucked, so I had to get out of there. I went to Ohio State, and then I said, blood is not thicker than water. There's a handful of relatives, and now it's just a few friends, my audience, you today, Sonny, and of course, because you're a great, terrific guy, and my wife, and that's it.
Family should be important. I know that I take total responsibility for the parents I had, you know, and although, you know, I feel I lived under an assumed childhood, quite frankly. My mother, nothing changes. She drove me nuts. She drove me nuts. She talked in a double language that I don't get it. I just don't get it. She made my dog, I had one pet. And I never had luck with pets because I live alone in LA, and I've had about 30 turtles, little turtles that have killed themselves. These little turtles, by the way, I think they're outlawed now because they're suicidal, these things. It's just, every time I come home, I open the door and I go, oh, Pokey's dead. But I had a dog, Trico, that committed suicide because my mother just drove the dog nuts. And she talks in double messages. She'll take a bone and she'll throw it and she'll say to the Trico, she said, don't fetch that, see what I care. Okay? So the dog goes, should I not get it for her? Am I not getting it for me? What do you do? And then, and the dog finally did it. I heard that he was like whistling like little prison tunes in the backyard. I knew it was not good. She actually said to Trico, you can't come in the house and you can't go out of the house. Well, you know, what's the dog gonna do? He was doomed. Midair was the only thing left. I just thought, and my father, he meant well, I guess. He was never home. You know, I don't know if I'm ever going to be, I don't know what to do. We had a picture, an 8x10 picture, chemically treated. So we knew, like, it would turn blue if he would have been pissed off by something we said. He just wasn't around, you know. He went to work all the time. He gave us, like, a little obligatory kind of stories. Like, at, like, 3 a.m, like, 4 years old, and you're lying in bed. He'd come, hi, how you doing? Hansel and Gretel, gotta go to work. And he always would cut me off. I mean, that's why I think I did this, whatever I'm doing. I needed to talk to someone. I mean, I'd be sitting around the table, I'd go, you know, I have a lot of sexual problems, pissed at me, love. So he'd cut me off. The only way I could express myself, I had to be like, I had to just leap and talk. It was sort of like, I'm a homosexual communist lesbian. I had to get his attention. And he gave advice from hell. He didn't know what he was talking about. He'd say, you know, never kill praying mantis. Why, Dad? Well, they help catch kidnappers. Okay, thank you very much. What does that mean? He told me how to swim. I mean, I was 4 years old. He took me to a pool, an edge of a pool, deep end. He got behind me and he went, find Atlantis. And he said, never, ever, like, here's the two things that destroyed me. He says, never show a dog you're afraid. Well, I'll tell you right now, there was a Nazi Doberman pincher that terrorized our neighborhood. It was a giant dog. It was like a seventh wonder of the world. It was like almost like in a Doberman float parade on New Year's Day. And they had to build this 30-yard link fence, and he had a helmet on. He was like two-step down the street to destroy us. And one day I confronted this pincher. I said, look, I'm not frightened of you. And the dog, he made a book. If I had like a lamb chop hanging on my neck, a perfect leap. And he said to me, you know, I wouldn't have bit you, but you were too cocky. You were too cocky about it. But when he said, never run from a bee, I'll tell you right now, I wish you well. I hope you have great advice. I don't know. It's a nightmare. I was in these Cub Scouts, and I went to a park, and it might as well have been like a New Year's Day thing, a bulb coming down that said, beehive, run for your lives, because everyone ran. I looked around. No one was there but me, but I heard that little schmucky advice, don't run for a bee. I stood there, and the bees, they started coming at me, and they were shaking their wings in disbelief. They couldn't believe it. And the queen bee, I said, I heard her talking, like in bee language. She brought a therapist bee on a little couch to talk to me. They talked me out of standing there. They started stinging condolence cards on my forehead. I was doomed. And then the next day they erected like I'm a schmuck statue in the park, you know. I think I turned that over. That was one of the subtlest things of all time. But I just want to take a breath for a second because I just, I'm getting a rash.
Well, congratulations, by the way, on your wife.
Well, thank you. The fact that she even wanted to marry me is—I'm convinced it's a hoax. I'm convinced she's part of some, like, you know, like that Truman Show. You know, I think that she's part of some kind of reality show.
Well, either marry somebody who loves you or someone who's a great liar. That's what they say, you know.
No, but I trust her more than anyone. But the fact that I, you know, have such, you know, self-loathing. And I do. I'm grateful to be alive, recovered alcoholic and drug addict for almost 11 years now, which is good. But I have so much clarity now, Sonny. I feel like I despise myself more than I've ever had because I see who I really am.
You really got a clearer picture, right?
A clearer picture of how whacked I was. I mean, this date from hell, wife from hell, all that metaphor I use, which fortunately Larry David and Curb sort of helped immortalize, putting it in a show.
Right.
The truth of the matter is, I don't preach about this stuff. It was my journey. I mean, I should be dead. So the fact that I got sober kept me alive. But the truth is, once I realized that I had to take responsibility for how whacked I was, I became the date from hell. I mean, I did date some satanic women. There is no question. I mean, vampires. There's no doubt.
I
was pretty whacked.
I was surprised. I was watching an interview, which comes with a DVD. By the way, we're here to talk about Concerts from Hell.
The Vintage Years, which is right. An homage to my drinking. Yeah.
The Showtime special, the original one, and then the two HBO specials. But I was going to say, during the interview, you said something that I didn't even realize. It came to me that you...
What, that I was a woman?
No, that you looked like shit in that lighting in that interview. No.
Babe, did you see what they put me?
You look like Count Chocula.
I thought I was a prisoner of war with my own label. I really did. I was going to actually call... I'm a Democrat, but it doesn't matter. But I was going to call McCain to try to get some troops and save me from the interview.
No, there's an interview.
I don't mind the interview, but where they put me, not that I expected like some lavish set, but this was, I felt like Papillon.
Well, it was the black and white trick with your outfit on, you know. By the way, you ripped off Johnny Cash, so fuck you on the from him.
I did, and he ripped off fucking Paladin, so blow me.
That's true, he did.
I know.
Anyway, back to, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, you said, you made a point that I didn't even realize, that you used to dump on your exes. You go on stage, she was about, and now it's you that you're dumping on.
Well, some of the exes were pretty rotten, but I was, you know, listen, I'm a decent guy who drank and did drugs to excess, so when I was in some of those periods, I was not a great guy, but you know. But at the core, I'm a decent human being. That's the truth. If I can give myself a little credit.
Sure.
So, but I wound up staying in relationships that sucked because I didn't feel I deserved good ones. I found a great woman, and I married her. And again, I feel it's a hoax because it's such a. It came so late in my life that I almost feel like it's too good to be true. Or she's, you know, this is some really devious practical joke, and it'll be really. And you know what? I could take it. I could take it if it is.
But if you turn, the point I'm trying to get at, will you turn your...
Yeah, when are you going to... Why don't you fax me the point tomorrow? Then I'll call all your listeners, because this is... Are you okay? You need a vocabulary intervention?
No.
I know, you're very bright, Sonny. I'm teasing.
You've turned your ire from your exes to yourself. And I'm wondering if that had something to do with one of the 12 steps. You get my point?
No. When I got sober, I realized that I was told that I had to take lots of responsibility for my actions, and all the consequences with bad relationships. It wasn't just the date from hell. I was also many times a date from hell as well. So it didn't have. I had to. Now I turn the lens on me. In the last 11 years, my stand-up has been more exciting than ever for me because it opened up a Pandora's box of hell and that I just never really copped to. That's why back then I was an active alcoholic, and it's interesting and sometimes painful to watch me. But when I talk about it, get to your point, I did really basically say date from hell, mother from hell. Everyone was to blame but me.
Right.
And it's interesting to watch these because now I've turned it back on mostly on me. And but I wanted to at least set the record straight and put these out.
Now, when you sat down and watched all three of these concerts that's on this DVD, was that painful for you?
No, I actually was. It was joyous in knowing how hard I worked and how long I struggled, how I never gave up, and that. I mean, the first one, I'm in Pain, was almost 11 years after I became a comedian. That's a long haul.
But the whole thing comes down to me. It's for sex. Sex is a key. It should be a great thing in your life, and I want it to be in my life. But I'm concerned about dating. It's very tough to date. Diseases are, I don't know. I just one night stands. You're with a strange guy, a strange woman. You don't know. I mean, like, is it worth it for that one moment of ecstasy to wake up? Oh my God, there's a fez growing out of you. No, there's one woman said, I haven't made love in 3 months. Me neither. I just want companionship. We make love. Next day, the call right from the clinic. Hi, I'm sorry. I have this thing. You have to take this. You told me you haven't made love. No, the doctor said it was either from oral sex or witnessing a meteor shower. Might have been witnessing. And you have to take this. You can't drink for 118 days. You have to mow people's lawns. Oh, God, it was like a creator. Are there any side effects? Well, you might turn into a cigar. Two people did in Sweden. So my ex breaks up with me. She's bad-mouthing me all over town. She told my friends that she had the fake foreplay, which was humiliating. I tried my best. Now I feel guilty for having a bad sex life with her, and I don't allow myself even to have an orgasm now unless I commit to about 6 to 8 weeks of community service, which I feel is sort of a... And this birth control stuff is so unfair for women to have to go through these things and the things. And I don't even know what they look. I mean, they scare. I mean, the sponge and the thing and the thing and the red. It's unfair. And yet, I feel very insensitive about this. I said to this woman, look, you don't use anything. I'm curious. She said, I know my body. I said, what do you use? I just have to know. She said, a rabbit's foot. It was not enough for me. She said, it's not enough for me. I'll never be able to function. She said, well, I know my body. What do you mean you know your body? She had a little chart. Okay, the Aurora Borealis is over here. I don't have my period until 1985, and you have to wear a wizard's hat on Wednesday. I can't. It's, you know, just, So I went to a sex counselor. Forget about that. Oh, God, he prescribed, just try to get intimate again, like the first couple of weeks, hay rides, you know. I mean, it went too slow for me. It's way too slow. And the simultaneous orgasm, I know it's crucial. I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't even know anymore. I didn't even know she had an orgasm. I said, did you have an orgasm? I don't know. We shoot a flare over the house soon. I have to know. You know, we tried that orgasm at the same time. The doctor told her to shoot a 2-minute warning in bed, which was, it took away all the heat, you know? I just, you want to be hot. You can't stay hot the whole time. That's what I don't know. You can't be hot with the same person forever. You have to dip. I know it gets sort of sad, you know, when you say, tonight, you be the caterer, I'll be the insurance man, you know? You come in with a Chef Boyardee hat and a spatula. It's time, and then it went south already, you know? And I want to express myself sexually. That's the key, to be able to have, to be myself. I yodeled once. I had a yodel breakthrough. I yodeled, and then she came in the room, and I panicked. I got tongue-tied, because I can't be me. I become like Jerry Lewis. I can't talk and make love at the same time. I go, I really love Hellman. It's sad, it's sad. I have, but Hellman, it's sad. It's just, well, how do you do it? The best I could ever do, well, in the hottest moment, making love with this woman, I said to her, you know, you're zany and delightful. I said that.
People don't understand, particularly back then, when I started in 71 with Jay and Crystal and Andy Kaufman and Freddie Prinze, it was really only a handful of comics that were really getting good spots. Everybody else was like a big star comedian or us.
Right.
And it really was, there weren't like the nightclubs all over the country, and it was a whole other world back then. So, you know, it really made me feel good that, you know, and I was broke most of the time and lived in real dumps. And I said, you know what, this is what I wanted to do. I had a real passion for it. And that's one of the reasons I don't have much tolerance for people in the business when they're starting out, when they get impatient, because, you know, back then, you know, the 20 or 30 of us who were trying to make a living doing this and weren't, you know, until we got a break, you know, we really had to want to be comedians or else we had no shot in the world. And that's why 95% of the people I knew back then aren't comedians anymore, because, well, first of all, you got to get a break, but you got to really want to love it, and you really got to want to marry this profession, or else it's almost impossible to make it. So I felt good about that. The only downside was it's hard to extricate myself now as a sober man, almost 12 years, looking at myself, knowing that after the show, like I remember, like, you know, I would get obliterated many times. I usually showed up pretty cool. Sometimes if I didn't, I would, you know, they put me in a shower and I would get it together. Most of the time I showed up because I treated stand up like my child, basically, you know. Right. But still, as a human being and as a man, a sober man now, when I look back and looked at and remember all the things that were going on in my life socially and all the things I missed doing, like forgetting all my nephew's birthdays from time, and every, you know, you name it, from A to Z, I felt a little melancholy and a little sad. But on the flip side is that, you know what, at least I'm not dead, and at least I'm still doing, I'm talking to you. Things are great. I have my fifth year in the can with Larry David, one of the most brilliant, you know, comic minds ever. And, you know, so I'm not, you know, I'm very grateful. But, you know, it's hard not to think back at how I was living after the show,
right,
or before. And, you know, but you know what? You can't have it both ways. So, you know, I'd rather look back now sober than be dead. You know, so there it is. And that's funny, isn't it? I think I'll open up with that on Letterman next week.
I'll interrupt your funny band.
No, I'm going to open up with, I'm doing about 3 or 4 talk shows. Hi, Dave. You know, I'm so glad I'm doing your show and not dead. Can we take a commercial break?
Let's talk about I'm in Pain for a second. The energy level.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Now, were you energetic, or were you doing a lot of cocaine, or what?
No. I might have had a glass of wine early in the afternoon. I was absolutely, basically sober as you could be. And one of the reasons was this was the first special that I ever had a chance. It was 14 years into my career. It was do or die.
This was important. This
was it. And that's why I chose the Improv, because that's where I started 14 years before in New York, when there was a club on 44th and 9th and down by the Actors Studio there. And, you know, the thing is, this was it. I had a feeling. I mean, I was doing Tonight shows and Lettermans, but this was my first real shot at showing, you know, a huge portion of the comedy people what I can do live. And, you know, millions of people saw it. And luckily, it got terrific press. And you know, the truth of the matter is I only had one shot at it. Most people do two shows and edit it, although I never do the same show twice, and it drove my directors consequently through the years, you know, crazy. But nevertheless, for some reason, it wasn't finessed in my deal to do two shows that night and edit the, you know, the best part. So this was do or die for me, and I did about a 90-minute show, which they edited down to almost an hour, and fortunately it worked. Otherwise, you know, you just don't know what would have happened. I would never have quit, but I mean, it was clear that I had to do well on this, or it would have been a setback. And so my energy level was like I was shot out of a cannon, as you say, and correctly so. I mean, I had 14 years of material lying on my head and on that sheet of paper.
Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Lewis.
Thank you very much. Wow, thank you very much. I am so incredibly, well, here, I got to tell you, I just spent about a week with family, and I am absolutely thrilled and delighted to be here in front of strangers. You have no idea. Can't believe it. My mother, she put a satellite dish up. I said, gee, why aren't you into sports? And I can't imagine discussing like the pennant race with it. But it was, believe me, it was like, it had to be like a Jewish satellite dish. It picked up problems from other families. It's like... Oh. I gotta learn how to breathe. I wanna relax. I'm glad to be here. I'm walking to the club. I'm walking to this club. I've been here years. It's unbelievable. I'm just trying to relax. I walk to the club, tippy-toe in, to avoid any kind of anxiety. And hey, what happens? A car is like sort of driving down. There's a guy without his headlights on. So they have these like loud speakers. It's like, you know, Yankee Stadium on top of the car. And the cop goes, I get confused myself, but I'm to the cop car now. The cop goes, put on your headlights. So, oh, sure. The guy put it on, but he like went over a canyon. It was so counterproductive, you know? And I'm just walking alone. The cop sees me, goes, stop blaming your childhood. He's like, oh, you know, kind of like.
We're talking to Richard Lewis, who has a DVD out. It's three concerts, the first Showtime and the two HBO specials. And now let's talk about the fact that after this first success, by the way, I thought the first one, I'm in Pain, was done in Chicago.
That was done at the Improv in L.A. And the other two, I'm Exhausted, I'm Doomed, were done at two venues in Chicago. Oh, okay. Chicago's been an amazing city for me.
But after the first one, I'm in Pain, which was what, 88?
85. And the other ones are 88 and 90.
Then all of a sudden, along with Carson and David Letterman, who helped you a great deal.
Huge.
Huge, right. And you had like an open door policy there. You go out to Hollywood. And eventually to make a long story short.
Well, I was in Hollywood. Yeah, but I wasn't. But then, long story short, I finally got a real huge break where 40, 50 million people would see this nutcase.
Right. Now, that's what I was going to say. This first special helped lead to the TV show, Anything But Love.
Yeah.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Jamie Lee, yeah.
I got to tell you something. I love the show, but underneath, I don't know if anybody else felt this way, but I felt in real life, you and her are like gasoline and water. Now, is that true? In real life, when you
we're soulmates.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I didn't know.
No, it's interesting. You're the only person other than Mother Teresa who had that that impression. No, we're best of friends now. Best,
really?
We always were. No, I don't know. It's interesting. The only thing you might have seen in my face is that, and I begged the producers for us to have intercourse on television. I couldn't take it anymore. I mean, I used to be on the road and cab drivers go, hey, what's wrong with you? You got Jamie Lee over here, over there. You don't make love. What's with you? You know, I couldn't take it. I couldn't take it. And I said, you know, we should be lovers. So finally, in the second year, and that was great because I used to look at every script. You know, I mean, what's wrong with, you know, making out with her? I mean, it was fabulous.
Right.
So, I mean, I would look at, I get the script at the end of the week and I would speed read it and see, you know, oh, we're in bed, yo! You know, because rehearsal was like unbelievable.
A guy who goes on stage and really ad-libs, stream of consciousness, you know, Letty Bruce, whatever, I know it was one of your heroes. How is that? Well, how did you translate that into going into a studio every day with a script and an approved script by the censors? And how did that work for you?
I'll say this. Thank God for Curb Your Enthusiasm, because any person who's a writer, I mean, that's all ad lib. So, I mean, I can't ever get, this is like Nirvana being on Curb Your Enthusiasm. But on that show, on other shows I've done, quite frankly, and everyone knows this, I mean, it's a scripted show has about 10 to 15 writer producers. It's most scripts, unless a show is run by a very strong showrunner, and this is true, like a Carl Reiner or a Larry David or a Norman Lear, and there's so many, and maybe a handful of men and women who say everything goes through me,
right?
And they write the ultimate final script, and they have the say so. It's usually a hodgepodge of oftentimes many brilliant writers, but so many of them that the script's unwieldy and it's different sensibilities. So I, of course, used to fax every... I hardly slept for 4 years. I would fax my 2 cents. But, you know, in that particular show, it wasn't, you know... Usually it's the writers versus the actors, and that's what it is. I mean, it's true in Hollywood, and, you know, and they wanted to perceive me as one of the stars of the show, and so my writing didn't, you know, even though they say, you know, sometimes you see on the show, they go, he's a, you know, what do you call it? Not a contributor.
Script consultant.
Consultant. That was a lot of bullshit, because I didn't, you know... I'm lucky if I got the word yarmulke in, if I was lucky.
So my question to you was, how did you handle that? Did you enjoy it?
No, I didn't enjoy that aspect. I enjoyed the show. I thought the show was a good show. The cast was superlative. And I loved working with the people, except as a writer, a proud member of the Writers Guild for almost 30 years, you know, my writing head was really felt bashed because, you know, they just didn't want to listen to me. And you know what? I understand, as a writer, if you start listening to any actor, then all of a sudden, and the word gets around, then the rest of the cast is like a mutiny, like in a minute.
Right.
So, you know, you got to sort of, you know, I understand from the producing end why they have to do that. But I'm a writer and a comedian. So, you know, it was it's always tough for me. That's why Curb Your Enthusiasm is heaven sent. I'll never be able to repeat this kind of experience I have with Larry David.
Well, every
word is my own.
Let's segue to that, because the premiere on HBO. Now, you're in the first episode, or the new episode.
I'm in the first, and I'm in a lot of the other ones, too. And it's a really dark arc, and it's phenomenal.
Can I ask you a real dumb question?
What's different than the other ones? You've humiliated yourself
you
in the journalism world.
I set you up.
I had to do that. Know why? Bud Abbott's ghost came down and bit my ass. And said, if you don't say that, you're out of the business.
Anyway, the episode of you and Larry knowing each other or realizing you knew each other was a kid and you hated
each
other.
That's a true story.
Is it true?
We went to a camp. We were 12. He was an idiot. I was an idiot. I didn't have a drinking problem. Then I was just I had an idiot problem.
It's a true
story.
True,
and then we met at the improv. To this day, he doesn't admit, because I started a year before him, that he said, Mr. Lewis, can I have a ride across town? He will not cop this calling him Mr. Lewis. He was a brilliant stand-up, and we both became best friends. And one night, long story short, I looked in his eyes, and he looked vaguely familiar, but in a horrific way, and we retraced our childhood, and we became that Larry and Richard from 13 years ago when we were 12, and we flipped out. I mean, we almost came to blows. Like we've always had a love-hate, not a hate, a love kind of vitriolic kind of. I mean, we always are yelling and screaming at each other, but then we can turn on a dime and be best of friends. I mean, we'll always best, but turn on a dime and be nice. It's just right. We're very argumentative, and I think the show shows that a lot too, that we care about each other, but we're able to scream and yell, but do it in a funny way.
I've been all over, and it's just really, it's really amazing to me. You know, comedy is really, all of a sudden I'm doing a lecture at Hunter College. I don't know what happened to me. Oh, I know why. I know why I was doing that. I was doing this gig up in Maine about a month ago, and I got freaked out because, you know, some gigs are a nightmare. Some gigs are gigs from hell. And I walked up in the afternoon. I see my sign, and it was off near Maine. It was near Maine. And had tonight, Richard Lewis and King Crab. I went, what, King Crab? I was on the bill with King Crab. I said, maybe it's like some kind of rock group. I saw maybe guys, you know, saxophone guys coming out.
But that was it. I was on with the entree. That was the whole trip. And I walk into the club, and the people go, "Hi, do we get to the waitress? Do we get the French fries with the comic or not? We're not sure, you know." I'm doing my gig, not doing well. It was a nightmare, quite frankly. There's about 30 people there in the middle of my act. It's right on the inlet or a sand with a bay. Who cares at this point? I hate the place. But a guy runs in from the back of the club wearing like a yellow raincoat, a slicker, whatever. And he screams out, "The tuna is biting." And the entire audience just got to...
I've been told by some sources that during the course of making an episode, say when you're sitting there and they gather you around and go, "Okay, you're all going to go in and buy this restaurant or whatever." Is it true that each of you have a secret line that is designed basically to crack the other person up? Is there a game going on there?
Boy, you really. I'm going to have to come out. You're not smoking opium, are you, doing this?
No,
there is no secret line. Which is a quiz show in the 60s?
I was told that it's a game you guys have sort of devised, that you've got a line that's outside of the script altogether.
No.
And you do it just to get a reaction.
Let me tell you something. Larry David, it's like he makes Woody Allen look like he's going to give information. Now, Woody, you know, you do a Woody Allen movie, which I haven't, unfortunately, but I have millions of friends who have. You get like three pages and then you show up and, you know, you do your you don't even know what's, you know, but he's such a genius, it works out. Same with Larry. He doesn't tell you anything till the bitter end. He says, "All right, you're pissed off because I got to see the dentist before you, but you were here first," or whatever, action. And that's it. No secret lines. I don't know where you heard this from. Some guy, you know, some snake dancer in India on the top of a mountain. Listen, if you're going to go to the Himalayas and have all these epiphanies, save it for your fucking free time. Don't waste my time and your viewers and your listeners, because we don't care.
Actually,
we don't care if you're going to spread these dumb rumors about Curb.
That was from a very, very jealous person who works here at XM, who's supposed to know everything. So I thought I'd pass it along.
Tell that person, really.
His name is Bruce
Kelly. Anything
But
Love. Tell Bruce to go on the Anything But Love website with the other five people that put me down.
Good. I love that. Anyway, but you mentioned also the joy of working in a situation like that with all the freedom.
The best.
And it reminded me, let me ask you a personal question. Did you have you watched 6 Feet Under?
Of course.
All right. Well, did you see the last episode last weekend?
No, because I was on the road. I have it taped.
Oh, it's one of those. It's a good thing you do. It's one of those things where you've got to rewind it and watch the ending at least
two, three times.
Because there's so much, it's like a Sgt. Pepper's album cover.
Like a Beatles thing, huh?
Oh, it is. Wow. I mean, you've got to look in the background, because I can't even tell you what happens. It's absolutely amazing.
Good.
During 2 weeks ago, before that show ended, the last episode, they had a retrospective, a couple of half-hour specials with the guy that wrote it and created it.
American Beauty, Ball.
Right. He was talking about it, and they were interviewing the actors and all that, and you usually expect them to say, "Well, it's a shame, we're all like family, and so..." But I got to thinking, what are these people going to do now? After all that creativeness, all that freedom on HBO, all that dialogue, that beautiful script, now if they're going to keep working as an actor, they've got to go take some piece of shit job in a movie.
Not necessarily.
A lot of them are Broadway play actors, right?
The bottom line is this. Here's the deal. They were very blessed to be in a phenomenal series.
Right.
You know, 5% of the people, and you people have heard this, you know, the 5% of the people in SAG make about, you know, don't even make over $5,000 a year. It's a joke. I mean, if you're going to devote yourself to the arts, if you make a living, it's almost like gravy, you know.
Right.
But if you're going to make a salary and on top of it be on an HBO series like that, I mean, they have to just be internally grateful. It'll probably lead to much better roles and more auditions and the whole lot. So... No, there's no downside to being on a show like that. And, it's fab. And for me as a comedian and as an actor and a writer, there's no downside to being opposite, not to mention a childhood friend who I love. I mean, to play opposite Larry David, you know, for 5 years, it doesn't get any better than this. Like you were talking about sitcoms, it's a scripted. Look, there have been great, unbelievable scripted sitcoms. I love the written word. But as a comedian, a stand-up who wants to maybe throw in his 2 cents every now and then, it's very difficult the way the shows are run, and everyone knows that. So in this show, he just tells you the environment and what the little scene's about, and then you're left to your own devices, and it doesn't get any better.
There must be an awful lot of tape, unusable tape, if you guys crack it up and stuff. I mean,
they don't shoot that many. I mean, once we know what we have to do and what the story is in that scene. Oh, cracking up. Larry is the worst at that. I mean...
Tell us some stories.
First of all, Larry is... Larry, first of all, I think Larry's he already got an Emmy nominated for acting, and he's wonderful this season. He's just a natural actor. And but he, you know, he approaches acting. I don't know how he approaches it, but it works, okay? You know, I bring into this thing, and the first few years, I drove him crazy because, I mean, I studied acting and Stanislavski and blah, 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 and the method and all. But this is not what that's all about. So when I was asking him, gee, what happened to this guy 3 weeks ago? Larry would start screaming at me and like, I don't want to tell you and does it matter? So I had to like almost become like a whole type, a different kind of actor. I mean, it is acting, but it's heightened realism. But Larry, because of the way he approaches his acting, and he's so naturalistic, that when someone would come on and that was very, very real and just blew him away, he could not take it. And he would sometimes stop production for almost an hour.
Really?
He could not keep a straight face. I mean, luckily the camera's always on him, on the other people. I mean, there is a scene, I will say this, the first scene in the first episode where we are, and I'll just say it's a... where Larry and I have our first fight in the first episode, I was in a mood where nothing was going to make me crack up. And you can see it in my face. And I'm telling you, Larry stopped shooting. We must have taken 2.5 hours to do this one argument. And I cannot wait to take the outtake reels. I mean, and there was a lot of people there, and there was nothing he could do. He lost it. And I know why he lost it, because I did not smile one moment. And when I was doing it so dead on real, he lost it. I mean, and I love making him laugh like that, because when you make him laugh, then you know you're on the right track.
So I went to a sex counselor. Forget about that. Oh, God, he prescribed, like, just try to get intimate again, like the first couple of weeks, hay rides, you know. I mean, it went too slow for me. This is way too slow. And the simultaneous orgasm, I know it's crucial. I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't even know anymore. I didn't even know she had an orgasm. I said, did you have an orgasm? I don't know. We shoot a flare over the house soon. I have to know. You know, we tried that orgasm at the same time. The doctor told her to shoot a 2-minute warning in bed, which was, it took away all the heat, you know? I just, you want to be hot. You can't stay hot the whole time. That's why I don't know. You can't be hot with the same person forever. You have to dip. I know it gets sort of sad, you know, when you say, like, tonight, you be the caterer, I'll be the insurance man, you know? You know, and you come in with a Chef Boyardee hat and a spatula. It's time, then it went south already, you know? And I want to express myself sexually. That's the key, to be able to have, to be myself. I can't. I yodeled once. I had a yodel breakthrough. I yodeled. And then she came in the room and I panicked. I got tongue-tied. I can't be me. I become like Jerry Lewis. I can't talk and make love at the same time. I go, I really love Hellman. It's sad, it's sad. It's Hellman. It's sad. It's just, well, how do you do it? You know, the best I could ever do, while in the hottest moment, making love with this woman, I said to her, you know, you're zany and delightful. I said that.
We're talking to Richard Lewis. You mentioned not doing a Woody Allen movie. I've heard you just...
Not yet, anyway. I read for one, though, for Crimes and Misdemeanors. I didn't get the role.
So you've met him. You've met him.
Oh, I've met Woody a few times, and I auditioned for him once, but an audition for Woody Allen is exactly what Larry David did, one or two or three of his films, you know, small roles in them. And I said, I'm reading for Woody today. This is like years ago. And he says, well, don't expect too much. I said, oh, come on. So I went to Woody's, where he does these auditions, and he told me exactly what was going to happen. I said, oh, bullshit. I mean, I see Woody at Nick games, and we've met, you know, I met him once. You know, we're not friends, but we've acquaintances.
Right.
Slightly acquaintances. And long story short, everything Larry David said was right. He said, you're going to walk in, you won't even see Woody, he'll be hiding behind the door. And Juliet Taylor, who is one of the great casting directors in history, who worked for Woody from day one, I believe, or almost, does all his movies for sure, and others, obviously, but he says, you're going to open the door, and Woody's going to say this, Juliet thinks you're right for this role, and she wants to, and we want to take a Polaroid. And I went, oh, that's the audition? He went, that's the audition. I walk in, and it was like 8 actresses and me. For some reason, I was reading for this little tiny role, and I know exactly what the role was, and it was like a quickie on the scene, on the screen, but I didn't get it. And I walk, and I said, Woody, where are you? And he's hiding behind the door, and he says, Juliet thinks you're right for this role, we want to take a Polaroid. They take a Polaroid. I'm ushered out immediately. I'm in there for 12 seconds. and all the actresses are putting on the makeup and looking themselves. And I did a whole Woody Allen routine. I went, because they couldn't believe I was in there for literally 8 seconds. And I went, we had a tremendous conversation about Bergman and Kafka. I just did a whole riff and they were laughing. And that was it. Not only that, I didn't get the role, but at least I didn't have to, at least Woody didn't make me wait too long. It was about 12 seconds, the whole thing in and out.
You've been described as a Woody Allen on steroids back in the 80s. I've heard that.
Well, you know, listen, the bottom, I found my own style, you know, years ago. But, you know, I really was always loved the greats. And, you know, Lenny Bruce was great for many reasons. Pryor was great for all unbelievable amount of reasons. And Woody Allen, I mean, it's very hard to find. There's many others, but not as many who had written as many one-liners, like a jeweler, really. I mean, he wrote one-liners. So I studied how, you know, the craft of stand-up, you know, through some of the greats, and then tried to find my own human, you know. I always tell you, like, writers always, you know, I remember a guy who wrote Taxi Driver and co-wrote Raging Bull, Paul Schrader, once said, I was at a seminar in California, a young writer, the Writers Guild, and he says, I wrote Taxi Driver in a couple of days, and blah, blah, blah. He says, but all you young writers out there, he says, you can write a great script better than me, better than anyone who's won Oscars, as long as you're true to yourself, because no one can write like you if you write what you know. And I took that and I applied it to stand-up. And I said, you know what? If no one can be Richard Lewis, if I have the balls to basically spill my guts. And that's where I then veered off and became myself, I think. And but you know, you gotta at least look and see who the best are, and you know, and
you mentioned
there was
that,
a handful of giants.
You mentioned that in the interview. I was really impressed. I expected it actually of you. You said if you're doing what you really love, which is stand up, making money and being famous is just gravy. You know, it's just.
I mean, it sounds, you know, like, you know, a little, you know, like a Hallmark card kind of thing. But the truth is, all I ever wanted to do was express myself and get validation. And I loved comedy. And then once I got I made a living at it, it was too good to be true. And then getting accolades or acclaim or kudos. And I mean, really, I've lived exactly the way I want. I mean, sure, everyone fucks up. We're only human. That's our biggest flaw. But I mean, you know, you can't change anything. So why even torment yourself about it? I'm really happy where I'm at right now.
Well,
except some of your questions have tormented me, but that's okay.
I've been very nice to you today.
Nah, you
yes,
had a couple of fucking Joe Frazier left hooks. I'm bleeding.
Louis Black said to me that.
Terrific guy.
Yes, he said one of the prerequisites for being successful, you have to find your own voice.
And he's absolutely right.
You only have one voice. But finding what that is sometimes very difficult. And you got to look in the mirror, and apparently, you've done a lot of that, especially recently.
Not in the mirror, but I did a lot. I did 3 decades of looking into a shrink's eyes.
Right. By the way, speaking of Woody Allen, I was blown away. I never realized it because I wasn't paying attention, I guess. But what he said, what his influence was, the man who influenced him, the man who
Bob Hope.
Yeah. Who? Right? And when he said that, I said, God, I went back and looked at all his movies over again, and it is Bob Hope.
Well, Bob Hope's style, Woody has said it many times, and I've read it numerous. Yeah, he loved Bob Hope, and I mean, he was a boy when he was raised on Bob Hope and others. But Bob Hope's kind of throwaway, his filmic acting, I think he means more than anything. He got a lot from Bob Hope's kind of cavalier, kind of throwing it out, very naturalistic style. And Woody has said that a number of times. And when I went back like you and looked at it, and I said, yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, we all came, we're all children looking at all these people that influence us. I mean, Oscar Levan, who is, you know, long time gone, but he was an amazing wit. And I used to see him on the Jack Parr show. He was a legendary, you know, drug addict and alcoholic and an amazing pianist, but as a humorist, he was. I remember one line on Parr. I mean, the guy was out of his mind, but brilliant, a genius. And he said that Parr asked him how he exercised. Now dig this. He said, I stumble, then fall into a coma. That was Oscar Levant. Now, you see, I know Phyllis Diller a long time. We're good friends. And I read her autobiography, by the way, which is stunning, which is out now. And when you look at people like that who've had really crazy adolescence and marriages and childhoods, and you think of Woody's past and Lenny Bruce and myself, if I throw myself in there, a lot of our low self-esteem, a lot of those jokes really cross over. And it's okay, but we have to just find our way. But one-liners sometimes are very similar. You know, I had a joke, you know, I faked foreplay, you know, and there's other jokes. Lotus Weinstock, who passed away, who was a great comedian and went out with Lenny, and she said that she, is it okay, Dear Abby, is it okay if I fake an orgasm when I masturbate? I mean, these are very close. So a lot of us, you know, who fall from the tree are not too, like even Shelley Berman, who I idolize and plays Larry David's father.
Right.
You know, I'm cut from that same cloth, that low self-esteem, self-effacing, neurotic kind of thing.
And, well, Rodney was great at that, too.
Oh, unbelievable. I mean, Rodney was sort of like a modern-day Woody Allen to me. But, you know, I mean, one joke after another. I mean, just watch him. It doesn't get much better than watching Rodney on with Johnny Carson, because Johnny just let him wail. And that's sort of, in a lot of ways, what Letterman gave to me. Letterman literally said to me in 1982, I'm getting my own show, and you come on as often as you want and just sit down and wail.
My family, I just, my mom, I sort of love her, but she things don't change. I go back to a house, it's wild to me. She has this cleanliness thing that I have now, unfortunately. I just, the dog, before it killed itself, she made this dog wipe its paws off before it came to the house. Just to me, it's sad. The dog got so nuts, it developed like a little nervous cough before it barked. It was sad. It was sad to see it. The dog used to go, I hate to see it. So I get to her house and she's vacuuming the front lawn. I don't understand it. How does she have a Hoover with a garden attachment? Where does she find this thing? And everything smells. Everyone smells. Why not? She has. I once bought her Airwick earrings. So every room, every place she went was cool, you know? She had a cottage cheese problem. She had to smell cottage cheese in the stores. I could see if you're home alone, okay? You smell. But she went right to that dairy case. But she was a big shot, quite frankly. Everyone knew because she knew. I really respect her for this because she knew when they were jerking us around. Because in that dairy case, they put the crap up front. You have to make a complete fool of yourself because, you know, you open the case and the cottage cheese has, like, on the bottom, like, hello from Ike, you know, on the front there, you know? You have to get, like, you know, guy from the Atomic Energy Commission with isotope. I'm going to get what I deserve, you bastards. You can't. It's impossible. So she knew that, but she was, you know, she made a fool of herself there. I mean, she would smell everybody's cottage and said, no, don't get this one. Go, you know, go back further. She had pictures, like, on Safeway stores with, like this and like this, like FBI things. And I was cesarean, and she always, you know, it was a tough birth, I guess. But she thought, I know exactly what tough birth. But I came out of, I don't know where, of somewhere, in an inappropriate spot, and it just, I feel like a little touched, quite frankly, by being a cesarean. I feel everybody, you know, I feel that I've spoken to people who've been cesarean, you know. I mean, like, if you go to a movie, and everybody's, like, walking out the front, I go, no, trust me, there's a hidden stairwell.
We're talking to Richard Lewis, who has a DVD out. It's a double DVD, right?
Yeah, it's almost 5 hours worth.
Right, so it's three concerts, the first Showtime and the two HBO specials. You've been around a long time.
35 years, yeah.
I didn't realize how long you've been. You've been around a long time. You were around when the...
71 I started.
Yeah, but you were mentioning the comedy club explosion. And some of,
in the 80s, yeah.
Right, when every titty bar turned into a comedy club.
I know, exactly.
By the way, as long as I brought that up, what is the strangest name you ever, club you ever played in? Do you remember?
Laugh You Pricks in the Deep South. And there was a hatchet vending machine in the back, and it was Klansman night, and I left.
I asked that. You know what Lewis Black said?
What?
The Winded Fag. No.
Oh, God.
No. Anyway, by the way, we're talking to Richard Lewis. Now, can I ask you a couple of personal things to end this with?
Yeah, but what has this been?
No.
What has this been? No. I'm naked here in the studio with
now,
you.
I saved this for last in case you didn't want to talk about it.
All right, go on.
I quit drinking about, it was 9 years
ago.
Did
you really?
Yeah.
Wow. You had to and you did. Good for you.
Yeah, I was on a very, very small... miniature little version of you, because I had a very popular radio show in Miami, and whenever you're popular and you're in show business, you can get away with shit, you know?
Yeah, I know.
But I heard you mention on the in the interview on your DVD about being a recovering alcoholic. And
I am a recovering alcoholic.
Well, I presume that sounds to me as if you're involved with AA, right?
No, that doesn't mean AA at all. AA is just one... AA is a 12-step program, and there's self-help groups. I'm familiar with AA. I'm familiar with a lot of different self-help groups. I have a drug and alcohol therapist I see. I have taken bits and pieces from almost every legitimate, I say legitimate, self-help group program. Some of them have 12 steps, some don't, but I've taken what works for me. I mean, if I didn't have other sober friends, I'd be, you know, if I was hanging around with, you know, with drug dealers, you know, and hookers, although nothing against hookers.
Which brings me back to your wonderful wife. I'm sure she's one of the biggest reasons you're happy.
Well, nice segue, hookers to my wife, you fuck. Wait till I catch you.
Richard Lewis, you're really a joy. It really is a pleasure.
Yeah, you're terrific, son. No, really. Yeah, and look under your sock on Christmas. You know what's there? Nothing. Nothing for mocking and humiliating me.
Many, many, many happy years.
No, Sonny, thanks, pal.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
Richard Lewis, this week's Foxcast number 6. Next week, of course, number 7. We hope you enjoyed today's broadcast, and we hope you join us next week. We won't tell you who it's going to be, but it's going to be great. Thanks for listening.